The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, this is Jeanette Garcia and I am here with Louis Ress on his podcast Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. This is episode 11, Learn to Play Tennis. And what has tennis have to do with law? Louis, what's the connection here? We're going to learn a little bit about that.
We are. I think the link here is luck. That's what every one of my stories, and this is in the book, has a hidden undercurrent of interesting concepts, of interesting theories, of interesting philosophies and observations. And this one really has to do with luck. Because the tennis activity that I had wound up having a big effect on me in my law practice. I had learned to play tennis as a child, and I played on my high school team. And in my senior year, I was a ball boy at Forest Hills and had my picture taken with the finalists, Pancho Gonzalez and Ted Schroeder. And the picture was taken on the balcony of the West Side Tennis Club. Of course, I didn't tell you that the West Side Tennis Club was totally restricted at the time. No blacks, no Jews. They let Hispanics in, provided you could
hit
the tennis
ball. Yeah, I was like, what was Pancho doing there?
Yeah, Pancho Gonzalez was the famous tennis player.
Oh.
And Seguro developed a two-handed backhand, you know, that you see in the tennis all the time.
Hmm.
It was nobody hit two-handed backhands except Seguro. And he also developed a two-handed forehand. Anyhow, it was a wonderful experience for me. In those days, you kept playing until you won the set by 2 games. And in the final set of the match, Gonzalez defeated Schroeder 20-18. It was a long match. And they wore spikes, and the grass on the court was all chewed up with the spikes. The public tennis courts in North Miami Beach, right near where we are now, were hard-polished concrete. They were located behind City Hall, and they still are, but nobody plays there anymore. There were open-air, palm thatch roof, a little house or hut in the corner against a stone wall, and that was the office from which the tennis pro assigned courts and sold tennis balls. It was open-air with a thatch roof, and the tennis pro was Nick Bollettieri. Well, Nick Bollettieri became a world-famous tennis coach. He's got the Bollettieri School of Tennis up mid-state. And Nick Bollettieri introduced me to Bernie Sayre, and Bernie and I played tennis. Bernie was very friendly. And he said, Louis, what do you do for a living? He said, where'd you go to school? You know, do you practice law? If you practice law the way you play tennis, my God, you're a tiger. Would you do some legal work for me? I hardly knew the man. But I said, I was struggling. I was making $50 a week at that time, and a wife to support, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't put food on the table. So I said, I would love to. And Bernie says, you didn't even ask me what I do. I said, look, I know I haven't, Bernie, but I'll do anything. He said, I'm an adjuster with the Aetna Casualty Insurance Company. Do you know what friendly suits are? I said, no, I don't know anything about it. He said, I'll teach you. Well, by this time, the Florida bar results had come in, and I was number 2 in the state, which was nice. And I don't know how I did it with those phony notes that I had. But my boss, George Case, was very impressed with me personally, but unimpressed with my being number 2 on the Florida bar. I think he was jealous. But my salary was up to $50 a week, which is the equivalent of about $500 a week today, or about $25,000 a year today.
No,
you could live on
not much.
And I didn't have enough money to buy office furniture. I was working at a card table that he had started out. He took from his garage and set up in the back room, in the file room, and that's where I was working. So Bernie Sayre explained to me what friendly suits are, that they're the legal papers used to settle claims of children. If you set out the facts and describe the accident and the injuries, and you explain the settlement amount in the papers, and you show that it was in the child's best interest to settle, the judge then approves it. A parent is usually named guardian of the funds, and I followed Bernie's forms. They came from one of the big downtown law firms. He copied them. And we used this information from the file. And it took me about an hour to prepare the papers. Bernie would bring in the parents and they would sign the papers. And sometimes the child would come to the courthouse too. And we would walk it through. And the courts were very accommodating. You had no trouble. You got assigned to a judge and you walk right in. And no matter what he was doing, he had time for you. It was unbelievable how nice the court system was. And he'd call you, Brother Res, how are you? And talk to you and offer you coffee.
Wow.
It was very nice. Not like today. And you would come away with an order approving the settlement. It took another hour, maybe. So all told, I had about 4 hours in the case.
Super smooth then.
Yeah, it was smooth. It was nice. And it was the same way in the probate court. The judge would sit down and award your fee and say, Lewis, what do you think would be a reasonable fee? And I would say, Judge, I don't know. You know, whatever you say, Judge, I'll take. And the judge said, how about this? And I'd always say, Judge, that's too much. That's much, much too much. I think half of that would be enough. That's how we dealt.
Wow.
And the judge expected you to do that. And the judge, that's why he awarded you the big fees in the first place, because he knew you weren't out for the money. You were out to be an officer of the court.
Mm-hmm.
And things have changed a lot. Anyhow, my first bill came back. I had 4 hours in it, and it was short and simple. I sent the bill to Bernie Sayer, and he sent it back to me with a note, call me. And the conversation was very short. Bernie says, double the bill and it'll be half of what the big boys charge. That one bill was $200.
Wow. You got a big break there.
Yeah, that was my entire monthly salary for 4 hours of work. And that was half of what the big boys charge.
Wow.
So Bernie was some contact. He sent me two friendly suits a week. And suddenly I had office furniture. And Bernie and I became friendly.
Mm-hmm.
He was my only client, my biggest client. He was a great client. And he wanted me to meet him at White Castle. I don't know if you know what White Castle is.
Burger place?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They had like 19-cent burgers.
Mm-hmm.
We were sitting there having burgers. And he said, what do you know about workers' compensation? I said, absolutely nothing. That wasn't exactly the truth, by the way, because I had worked on a workers' compensation case and assisted my boss, George Case, in a iron worker death case. And George had been an iron worker in the past, and he represented the union management organization. And I drew the agreement between union and management for the iron workers union. It was one of my first tasks in the office. So George had won the case, and I was just observing him. Well, it turns out that the Stanley Works, which is the Stanley Tool Company up in Connecticut, they're still around. They had a fractured coccyx case. And they were quite concerned about it, and they wanted me to defend it. And they were a national assured. In other words, the insurance company had all the Stanley Tool work and offices and everything for the whole United States was covered with by the Aetna. It was a big, big insured.
The coccyx is in the spine, correct?
The base of the spine.
Base of the spine, yeah.
Right, just where you sit down, right on the very end of your spine.
Yes.
That last little tip.
Yeah, you got to watch out for that.
Yes, you do. And they were very unhappy. They had never won a single, the Stanley had never won a single compensation case in the state of Florida. They always lost. The worker always won. There was a presumption that the injury was related to the employment, and the employees generally won. So the initial part of the case involved taking the sworn statement of the employee. This is called a deposition, and the employee is called the claimant. And the lawyers, well, we create our own language to cover up how simple most of the law practice really is. We make up, you know, fancy words. The main thing to know about workers' compensation is that it's a rough and tumble practice. The judge, he was known as a deputy commissioner at that time, listens to the parties and the witnesses, examines the evidence, and makes all of the findings of fact and decides the damages. It's a one-man band, and he rules or she rules. And this presumption that the injury is related to the employment is a very significant one.
Mm-hmm.
So comp lawyers, workers' compensation lawyers, are not the most elegant, refined, well-mannered ladies and gentlemen. At that time, all of them were men.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a scramble with objections flying all over the place. That's exactly what happened in my first deposition. The claimant's lawyer continually shouted objections. He said, objection, it's leading. Don't answer that question. It's already been asked and answered. And my client said that her back hit the table on the way down to the floor. Tell them how you hurt your back against the table. That's called leading. They pulled all kinds of dirty stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know what to do. I went over to the Stanley Works, to the window plant, which was not far from our office, and I took a look around there to see the scene of the accident. It was noisy, it was huge, it was dusty, it was dust all over the air. And they showed me a large table against which the claimant, Yolanda Bryan, said that she had struck her back. Something didn't feel right. There were two fellow workers who witnessed the fall. I spoke to them, and they confirmed the immediate onset of pain. They said they were there and she was in pain. Then I checked the ambulance records, and they had the same history of her back striking against the table as she fell to the floor, as did the hospital records, which I obtained by subpoena. You know, we send out a subpoena. Mm-hmm. The x-rays clearly showed a fractured coccyx. I saw them. And I took her doctor's deposition. That's the sworn statement, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, based on her history, he related the fracture to the accident. And he found that she suffered a 15% permanent partial disability to the body as a whole and could not engage in lifting over 15 pounds. Plus, there should be no repetitive bending. Plus, no standing on her feet for over an hour at a time in a work environment.
That makes it almost impossible to do anything.
Right, exactly. That's called permanent total disability. He swore that Yolanda would need periodic therapy for the remainder of her life. The claimant's employment expert said that with her limited education and her physical restrictions and her ongoing pain keeping her from being able to concentrate, that Yolanda was unemployable in the open labor market. Mm-hmm. Yolanda Bryan was 31 years of age and had a long work life expectancy. The employment expert said that she might ultimately need attendant care, but I noted that no doctor ever said that. He was embellishing.
Yeah.
The Stanley people were really upset. Lifetime medical benefits alone came to very big numbers, like over $1 million. And in those days, you could multiply by 10 compared to today. Mm-hmm. In addition, workers' compensation benefits for Yolanda's lifetime, reduced to the present worth value, was also a huge sum, over $1 million. On top of it, if they lost, they were responsible for Yolanda's attorney's fees and for all of the expert witness fees and all of the costs. Again, we're talking in the millions, millions. I spoke to a conservative orthopedic surgeon who questioned the history. He said to me that all fractured coccyx generally came from either birth, giving birth to a child. The child would cause the woman's coccyx to fracture when it was delivered. Or from sitting down compression type injuries where you slam down hard in a sitting position on the hard ground with the trauma coming directly to the base of the spine, not from a glancing blow like striking an object on the way down.
I see. Okay. That complicates things a little bit.
Right. Yet her medical history appeared to be clean. Yolanda Brown had moved to Miami about a year ago from Houston, Texas. Her employment application showed no past low back or spinal injuries. She passed a pre-exam physical, the pre-employment physical. She had worked hard and regularly up to the date of the accident with no lost time. Her work evaluations were good. Her employment application showed her social security number and her past address in Houston.
And real quick, what is a pre-employment physical?
Well, does that entail? Before you get a job, and very often in a plant or a factory, they require you to take a physical examination with the nurse or the doctor, and you fill out a form. Today, you fill out the same form, your medical history. Mm-hmm. You have a heart problem. Mm-hmm. Do you have a back problem? Are you suffering? Can you see? Are you suffering from mental disorder where you can't concentrate? Do you have any condition that would cause you to be unable to do the job, the tasks that would be assigned to you, or be a chronic absentee from the work? Mm-hmm. So everything showed. I don't know what motivated me, but her case was just too perfect. Something seemed to be wrong. I had a smell, something, especially when the doctor said that it wasn't the type of injury that you got from a glancing blow.
Right, of course. That sounds fishy.
Right. Yeah. That's what got me thinking. So I subpoenaed all records and any records relating to her from all five hospitals in Houston where she came from a year ago. And I set out her social security number and her prior address in Houston. And at that time, we were allowed to send out investigative subpoenas without filing with the judge or the court or without giving notice to the other side. In other words, just to get information, we could go on a search.
And what is a subpoena?
Is a court order, mm-hmm, with a seal on it, signed by the clerk of the court, saying to the person who receives it to produce documents. You got it today with Trump and with the White House, mm-hmm, and with, mm-hmm, Trump's financial records,
yes,
and Congress subpoenaing the records, the same thing. calling to bring it in under the authority of Congress, in this case, under the authority of the court.
To basically present these documents.
To produce it, mm-hmm. right? And the courts can require you to produce documents, your tax returns, whatever. So what
happened there?
Well, we were allowed to send out these subpoenas. I sent them out to all five of the hospitals, and bingo. At Houston General Hospital, a little over a year earlier, there was a record of a fractured coccyx from hitting the floor.
Oh.
The same lady, Yolanda Bryant.
Well, there you go.
Right. I kept my mouth shut. I didn't say anything.
Okay.
Because I knew that if I said anything, they'd say, oh, she aggravated it.
Hmm.
And so they changed their story, so I kept my mouth shut.
Smart.
The final hearing went forward before a very grouchy deputy commissioner. The witnesses confirmed Yolanda's tearful story. Since the accident, she couldn't bend over. She couldn't drive a car. She had to be helped with the groceries. She required rest periods in bed. The doctor swore that she was 15% disabled, and he listed her permanent limitations and her need for ongoing medical care. And, of course, the doctor said that he based his opinion on the history of the accident and the trauma and the
right.
x-rays and the fractured coccyx.
Mm-hmm.
Their employment expert testified at length. He described all of the tests he performed, including, psychiatric tests, work tests,
mm-hmm.
Intelligence tests, and he found her to be unemployable. The deputy commissioner was about to rule against this. The benefits came to over $3 million.
Wow.
In those days. That's
a
lot of money.
It's 10
times that. You're looking at $30 million today. So that's right. That's when a postage stamp was 3 cents. And that was 1956.
So what did you do, Lewis?
Well, I turned to the judge, because now I had them. I said, Your Honor, I only have one witness to call for the defense. He was ready to rule to stick it to us. I said, there's one witness, and he's listed. That witness is listed third from the bottom in my witness list. I put in the whole telephone book. I had about 20 witnesses in there, and he was buried. Sure enough, I called the custodian of the records of Houston General Hospital.
Mm.
Guy walks in. I flew him in to testify, and he walks in with the records. And the other side's looking, they don't know what's going on. And it took less than 5 minutes. And of course, he testified that she had, here's the records, and it was the same woman and the same social security number. And she had had the same injury, the exact same fractured coccyx. And here's the x-ray going back
wow.
2 years before. Well, the judge was ticked off. The judge slammed the gavel down. It was like an explosion, bang. And I jumped and he yelled, get her out of here. And that's what he shouted, and the claim denied. And after that, the Stanley Tool Company wanted me to handle all of their cases in South Florida.
You had their back.
Right, and the Aetna made me their workers' compensation specialist. I got it certified by the Aetna as one of their comp lawyers. And it was very good that I learned to play tennis.
Yes, yeah.
So
look at where
story.
It got you.
And
that's awesome.
So what's the story really about? And these stories are interesting to some degree, because they really stir up some good issues and questions.
Mm-hmm.
And this story is about luck, hard work, and insight. So it's two or three things. Luck is terrific. And I'm going to talk to you about luck. You know, the Asians believe in luck a lot. Did you know that it's part of Asian culture?
Hmm.
And it's called Joss.
J-O-S.
So you have good Joss.
Mm.
And it's particularly Chinese and also Japanese. But the Asians, they gamble a lot. And we'll talk about that.
And what
too.
Do they attribute it to? Is it some kind of spiritual thing? Or
what do you attribute luck to?
Yeah.
I mean, you're like, standing there and a lightning bolt hits, it happened to me, within 5 feet of where I'm standing and doesn't hit me.
Mm-hmm.
That's luck. That's a different kind of luck. So there's dumb luck,
mm-hmm.
and then there's controlled luck or contrived luck.
Yes.
I never thought about this until I started to think about the story that I wrote. Dumb luck is you didn't do anything and, you got lucky.
Yeah.
Contrived luck is you make your own opportunities. You get yourself in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You work to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if I hadn't gone to law school and I hadn't played tennis, I wouldn't have been in the right place and
cause
the right
and effect.
Time to meet
it's all about
Bernie.
Cause and effect, yeah.
And if Bernie wasn't looking for a young lawyer to take on the big law firms downtown Miami because they were discriminating against women and blacks and Jews and Hispanics, a lot of discrimination against Hispanics. If that hadn't happened and we hit like lightning, we hit together at the right moment, at the right time,
you're at the right
I
place
wouldn't
at the
be
right
here
time.
telling you the story, because through the Aetna, I wound up building a whole law practice from one client. It all
wow.
started with one big client. Bingo, it all opened. So, well, I was lucky that I won the workers' compensation case. I was lucky that I had an insight. Well, I was trained to think and to question, so it wasn't just pure luck. But I was lucky that I found it. The subpoenas could have come back negative, or that they didn't have any records about her. It may have occurred someplace else in a different city at a different time, her fracture.
Mm-hmm.
But I got lucky. And so it was two things. You make a lot of your luck, but a lot of it is just dumb luck.
It's
okay.
Also knowing, I guess, knowing how to act, what to look for, you know, in certain moments.
Right.
That then
right.
put you in a good position.
Right. So we talk about the right time and the right place. Take odds and gambling. I represented all the casinos in the Bahamas, all of them.
Really?
Everyone, including the ones that compete with one another.
Huh.
I represented Resorts International, and I represented Grand Bahama Development Company. So
you have some interesting cases you can share with us.
It's in the book. It's coming
okay.
up. You'll get there. I'll tell you about all the gambling in the Bahamas and what happens. And I've been in the counting rooms and everything.
Huh. I love it. I can't wait.
I took my wife into a counting room. But I don't gamble.
No?
No. And I know a good bit about it. And as I told you, I represented all
mm-hmm.
the competing casinos, so I know how they run.
You just don't see the point in it, really, probably from
oh,
everything
no,
you
there's
know.
There's a point in it. There's a wonderful point in it. And I love the horse races with the parimutuel, which is an entirely different kind of gambling. I like horses. I was involved with horses. I represented the stables through the Aetna. I represented everybody.
Wow.
I wound up representing the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
But and then they became self-insured, so I represented the Diocese of Miami. That's also luck. I was lucky to have them come to me. Anyhow, you talk about World War II and luck. There are countries that you wouldn't want to be in, too, where you're born, luck. First, talk about the military. The military, the army, in combat, I don't know if you know anything about what happened in World War II and D-Day.
Yes.
And so that was the invasion,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I visited there. I wasn't in the invasion. I
went to Normandy, actually.
You did?
And,
so,
yeah.
you know, so you
Omaha.
Did you see the cemetery up on the top
yes.
there? So that was a lot of luck for people that got through that and didn't get killed.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go inland with the hedgerows and fighting through the hedgerows, and you couldn't get the tanks in there. There's a lot of problems going on. When you jumped with the airborne, the 101st Airborne jumped in there, a lot of them got hung up on trees, and they got
mm-hmm.
they had problems, and they couldn't meet their group. They got captured and executed.
And the
of
individuals
them.
That the would climb the cliffs,
that,
and the Germans would just
those
cut
were the Rangers.
The Rangers, the Germans
right.
would just cut the rope. They would wait until they were
right.
all the way at the top, and
right,
it's just
right.
awful.
Right. Well, the system in World War II was that a certain unit, military unit, would be in charge, like in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you had casualties, they would bring in replacements. So you were in a group, let's say, of 12 men in a squad or 20 guys in a company, something like that. And you had or 40 guys in a company, you had replacements. So your buddy next to you got killed. Another guy would show up, another private with an M1 would show up next
yeah.
to you, and then he got killed and another guy. So to get through the war, you had to go through all of these replacements. You were hoping to get shot in the arm or the leg or something in the thigh and be put out or lose a finger.
Mm-hmm.
Then you couldn't go back.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they fixed you up and you went back on the line.
And the odds are against
and,
you.
Sure, the odds keep getting greater the longer you have to stay on the front lines,
mm-hmm.
and they just fill in the spots. Finally, they're going to get you. So that's a matter of luck to get through. Guys that got through the war came out with a different perspective in life, and that's part of luck. Also, talk about luck in the Air Force. The Air Force starts out with all the bombers, and everyone says, oh, it's wonderful to be in the Air Force, clean uniforms, no mud, you know, everyone salutes you, everyone's an officer. They have a lot of rank, a lot of high
mm-hmm.
ranking in the Air Force, not like the Army. I think there were more colonels in the Air Force than there were privates or second lieutenants.
Mm-hmm.
There were more colonels. Everybody had rank. So you got into a B-17, which was ultimately the the weapon on the Air Force in Europe, and you would fly these missions. Well, they had it so that if you did 25 missions, it was over. No more combat. Well, a lot of guys were making it through 25 missions, so they changed it to 50 missions.
Oh.
Not many guys made it through 50 missions. So they went out. I don't know if you ever heard of the raid on the Pulaski oil fields.
No.
World War II. I'm rambling, I know, but it's...
No, I want to hear all about it.
Well, Pulaski oil fields were in Romania, and they were providing the crude oil that was turned into diesel fuel to propel the tanks, the German tanks, the panzers.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans were great engineers, and I'm a very anti-German person. But back for years, I wouldn't put my foot in Germany. I was so ticked.
Really?
I was then in the military, and the service, I went over to Germany on some business. What?
Did you end up going?
Oh yeah, yeah. I wound up having a wonderful time in Berlin with my
there
wife.
You go.
We spent 2 weeks. There's a time to forgive but not forget.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
I went there. But Pulaski and their tanks, the Panzer tanks were unbelievable. They were better than ours. As much as you hear about American tanks, we had the Sherman tank, which was nothing. And who was the great tank commander in the United States Army? Patton.
Patton.
And he was a crazy guy.
Mm-hmm.
Very smart, but very crazy. Anyhow, the result was they wanted to stop the fuel. That's how you win the war. You don't win the war so much in combat because it's how many soldiers you lose and they lose. That's a war of attrition.
Mm-hmm.
And that was World War I. And that was the Civil War. That was terrible. And Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
But this was a much more war of mechanism.
Hmm.
So it was who was technically
Tactics.
More advanced. And then we had the atomic bomb, which was the height of technical work. And that ended the whole thing. But in order to stop the panzers, they had to knock out the fuel supply. And so they bombed the Pulaski oil fields, which would really choke it off.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent down 130 American B-17s from England. It's a long way to bomb. And how many do you think came back from that raid? 130 planes.
Two?
30 planes came back. You
I wouldn't
want to be.
I wouldn't want to.
So that's luck. We're talking about luck, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then... when the guys came back, and it still goes on in the military, and I was friendly with a lot of guys that had this syndrome, they had this guilt feeling of being lucky, that they were came out unscathed and their buddies all around them died.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting, it's stress, post-non-traumatic stress, which no one talks about. And casinos is a different story about betting. Casinos are two things. One, dumb luck. So what is dumb luck? You take the roulette wheel and you spin it. It's dumb luck. I like that better because you don't have to think. And they either have one green spot out of 50 or two green spots out of 50. If they have two green spots out of 50, it's like 8% against you. I know all the odds. One is like 4% against you. So if you go into a casino, you got to expect to lose, especially over the long haul. So why do people go? Because it's entertainment.
Yeah.
And that's so you pay to be entertained. So whether you see a floor show or you see a movie or you watch television, and it's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
There's an adrenaline rush.
And it's the unknown because you don't know what number is going to come up when that roulette
starts
spinning.
Right, you get all excited. I saw that on TV last night. The woman put the ball into the machine and it went down and it dropped into the $1 million mark and she won $1 million.
Oh, my.
So it's very exciting. What else can I tell you about luck? Well, where you're born, that's luck. The coming to Miami was luck, because Miami was developing and expanding, and it turned out that Miami expanded more than any other part of the state, and in more depth, and I was turned out to be right about being the center of the trade for the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But I never got involved in it directly. If you're in Cuba, you had a lot of problems, because in Cuba...
political problems.
Have you been there? Are you Cuban?
My family's Cuban. They
Cuban descent.
Experienced Castro. So.
Well, I was there. I was there in the revolution when Castro came in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back two more times for cultural exchanges to meet with artists. and musicians and educators and so on. And the artists were allowed to sell their paintings. I bought a lot of paintings and sculpture. You can't do that anymore. They stopped it because they were making money. They were making more money than anybody selling their paintings.
Right.
And then they had these businesses in the homes, restaurant in your house. And they stopped that pretty much because the people were making money. And you got the restaurant because your brother-in-law was in the government or something. So,
yeah, everything had to be controlled.
Right, it is. And the tour guide, when I was there, was an electrical engineer. I said, what are you doing being a tour guide with the education? That's very high-level education. And he said, well, I make more money. I make $20 a month, government-controlled income, working in as an engineer, and I make $20 an hour doing it as a tour guide.
Yeah. So, and they would also assign what career path most of the time. They would assign it. You didn't have a choice. It's wherever there was a lack or you know, they needed filling up.
Right.
Okay, you're going to be working in the post office.
Right.
There's
and
no
if
choice.
You've got a pair of new shoes, I saw this happen. You were reported by the house detective. There was every building had a house agent for the government.
Yes,
and they would report
they
anything unusual.
Mm-hmm.
You show up with a pair of new shoes, boy, you gotta had to go in and explain how you got them and where they came from.
Yes.
And most of the people are lucky there if they have a relative in the States or out of the country who sends them money.
Yeah.
You send $50 a month, that's double, more than double the income.
Mm-hmm.
And to people in Miami, $50 a month to help a relative is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my story about luck. I'll give you some of the areas. You say, well, I'm lucky. Well, the first thing I think that I consider is health.
Can't do anything without it.
Right. You wake up with a sore throat and you wind up with cancer. That's not good luck.
Yeah.
You have a disease and they cure it. That's good luck. Science comes along. My wife had a brain tumor and it was fatal. Until a certain time where they learned to go into the back of the brain and the skull, base of the skull, and be able to get the tumor out. They could never do it. They went in behind the ear. You're lucky.
Yeah.
So she was lucky. You're lucky to be living in America. Try El Salvador, Venezuela, Russia, Turkey, Cuba. Try a few places like that. Try a few places that are worse.
Mm-hmm.
Places in Africa where they still have slavery that nobody talks about. There are places in Africa today, as we speak right now, that have slavery.
Yes.
And the world chooses to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible.
We don't talk about it.
It's terrible.
Or and do anything
dissent,
about it, because it's not our problem.
If you open your mouth,
so.
You talk about the First Amendment to the Constitution, you know, freedom of speech. Well, there's no freedom of speech in most countries. I would say the bulk of the countries in the world, I don't know how many hundreds there are, but I would say the bulk of them do not have freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't appreciate it. We really don't. The best thing is we have the opportunity here to make our own luck. And that's what you do. You have to make your own luck. You have to learn to play tennis. You have to learn to try to get a job. If you don't apply, you don't get the job.
Yeah.
You know, I represented the Diocese of Miami, and there was a very, very religious lady there. And every day she went to church, not every week, and she prayed for an hour to win the lottery. And she prayed and prayed and prayed. And finally, one day, a ray of sunlight came through the stained glass window and struck her right on the head. And God spoke to her. And God said to her, you know, it's wonderful that you're praying every day to win the lottery, and I hear you, and you're such a devout lady, and I want to help you. But in order to win the lottery, you got to buy a ticket.
You got to buy a ticket.
And that's the end of the story. You got to buy a ticket.
You have to do your part. If you want to win
at
life, it doesn't just happen.
Right, you got to do your part.
Well, thank you, Lewis. Thank you so much for this. And you're a pretty lucky man, it seems, right? Would you say any different?
I'm the luckiest man I know.
That's good. Well, we'll see you next time.